Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Chris McGillivray on the show to talk about his new documentary film, Eden, a beautiful story about the succession of a historic winery in the Santa Cruz Mountains. Jeffrey and Ellie Patterson dedicated 40 years of their lives to Mount Eden Vineyards, and their children are wrestling with whether to carry on their family business or go off to pursue their own paths away from the mountain. The film Eden will premiere March 9th at 4:30 p.m. as part of the San Jose CineQuest Film Festival at the historic California Theater. Please enjoy our conversation. Chris, what were your favorite movies growing up?
When I was a kid, really Back to the Future is probably the movie I will have always seen more than any other movie in my entire life. There was something about that film that just like completely engrossed me, because I think it combined a couple of themes that I really loved. I mean, it's like this sort of a sci-fi film on the surface. You've got obviously time travel. You've got the like literally the coolest time travel vehicle anybody's ever come up with, that DeLorean. And, you know, you have a lot of really, really fun characters in there. I mean, Doc Brown was amazing. And, you know, Biff Tannen is amazing and so fun. And so you have all these things that, especially as a kid, you just connect to, and just, I could watch that movie over and over again. And it makes me smile, makes me laugh. But when you dig deeper, it's all of these really interesting themes about, you know, parents. And, you know, failure in particular, you know, like Marty McFly's parents, when that movie starts, he's a teenager, he's kind of embarrassed by his parents. You know, I think that, you know, both George and Lorraine's lives have not really gone the way that they thought it would. And both of their kids, Marty and his sister, are just kind of like embarrassed to be McFly's. And it's really cool because you get this opportunity through that film to, you know, go back in time and get a completely different perspective on your parents, because you get to literally see them at the same age that you are and see what they were like before, you know, maybe the life of hard knocks, you know, hit them a little bit. And then it's also really fun because it's all wrapped up in this concept that Marty actually gets to be involved in this key inflection point in their lives that is the life-defining moment. Mm-hmm. And he actually impacts how to be able to sort of give them the confidence to, you know, potentially be more successful. So that by the end of the film, he comes back and now all of a sudden his parents are a lot more successful. George is a successful writer, which was his dream, and Lorraine's in much better shape and, you know, not drinking so much, and they have more money. They're all, you know, much happier family. I don't know, man. That film always gets me every time. So,
yeah. Well, I think the definition of, or one of the definitions of great art is that it can speak different things to you at different points in your life, and you can come back to it and revisit it. You know, you might watch it for the special effects when you're a kid. You might watch it for what you're describing, thinking about regret, you know, as you become an adult, and then you look back at some of the choices you made and you fantasize about, you know, how, you know, if you could push a button and change one of those decisions, how that could affect you. And I think I also appreciate movies like that, that kind of have multiple subtexts that you can relate to at different points. So you got interested in movies, and then, like a lot of people, you were interested in going to USC film school to be, you know, to learn the craft and join the industry. Why wasn't it a good fit for you there specifically?
There were a couple key things I think I found, you know, like you hinted at, I figured out from pretty early age that I wanted to be a filmmaker, probably about 12 or 13. And, you know, I was thinking about things like, you know, Back to the Future. The Crow was another really, really influential film for me. That film came out when I was probably 13 or 14. And so I wanted to make these kind of, you know, bigger, you know, traditional Hollywood films, but that always had a little bit of an edge and a little bit of kind of a unique perspective. They were a little bit counterculture. And I got to film school, got to USC, and there were a couple of key things. one of the first things that I figured out pretty early is I was from Los Gatos, and I hadn't really lived a really that challenging or fascinating life. So I'd sit down, try and write stuff, and I realized I didn't really have much to say. I didn't, none of the stories were really connecting on a deeper level because I didn't know very much at that point. I'd watched a lot of movies, but I hadn't really lived a lot of life. And so that was a key one. And then the other big one was that the way that the USC Film School is really structured, they're really trying to, feed you into the Hollywood film system. And really the best way to be able to do that is to become a craftsperson, be able to identify what you are really passionate about and successful at. So if you're a really visual person, they try and push you towards, being a camera operator, potentially working your way up to being a cinematographer someday. Maybe if you love sort of the look and aesthetic of films, maybe you're in production design or fashion, that kind of thing. If you're really focused on the writing, then obviously you'd be a writer. But they're really from day one, they're like, most of you came into this wanting to be directors, but almost none of you are going to get a job as a director. It's very, very hard to get all the way up to that top level. So they're encouraging you to sort of break off and already identify sort of a craft approach. And that personally didn't really resonate with me. I wanted the opportunity to be able to really, develop myself as a filmmaker and try all the different crafts. I tried cinematography, I tried writing, I tried a little bit of acting, all those kind of things, but it was more of interest to me to actually be able to constantly be the director and the head of the project and get to sort of, jump into to those crafts a little bit. So I ended up leaving.
Yeah. And what does filmmaking look like outside of what they call the industry in California? Like, can you share your perspective in operating outside of that kind of
Sure.
that nexus of where a lot of the money and the resources and all that stuff originates?
It's a really interesting thing because obviously it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, and it's changed a lot over the years. But I guess for me at this point, I've been doing it for about close to 15 years as a very independent filmmaker in Northern California, up in Santa Cruz and around all throughout the Bay Area and all throughout California. I do a lot of things with a much smaller number of people than you would traditionally do a large studio film. So,
Yeah, like I just heard an interview this week with Denis Villeneuve, and he was describing, making Dune 2, and he was describing the process of moving 800 people into the middle of the desert. And he described like having to build roads and like
infrastructure.
sidewalks, it's wild.
It totally is, man. Like there is obviously an old saying in filmmaking, it takes an army, and that is fundamentally true. Back in the I think like the Kubrick Spartacus days, it's like I think they think that's probably the most number of people that will ever work on a film is like in Spartacus, just the
Yeah.
number of people that it took to be able to do that, the number of extras. And
Yeah,
that's a
yeah.
completely different thing. And then, so when you do that, you obviously have to have, a pretty strong hierarchy. There's, the director, there's the cinematographer, there's the camera operator, there's the, first assistant camera, there's second assistant camera, there's third assistant camera, there's assistant director, second assistant director. They all have very specific jobs. Like in that case, the second, camera operator or second AC is the one that loads the film or, deals with the digital media now. And when you get into independent film, the thing I personally love about it is that everybody kind of gets to wear a lot of different hats. I mean, most of this film I shot with a three-person crew. It's myself, my cinematographer, Isaiah Flores, and then a production sound guy. I had two, Daniel James Howell did it, very early, and then Michael Baba did it for a couple of years, in the 2020 and 2021. And we all end up wearing lots of different hats. So Michael's there, obviously, to record the audio, but he ends up helping out with the lighting with Isaiah. I end up shooting a good amount as well because I love cinematography, and we, tend to run two different cameras when we're doing, B-roll and imagery. So Isaiah's shooting and I'm shooting at the same time. And so it's kind of a more fun, freewheeling thing because you can really all do all different jobs, and it's a more, sort of collaborative effort.
Growing up in that area, were you aware of the wine industry? What was your kind of knowledge of it?
So I didn't really know anything about wine in particular. My father always loved agriculture, always loved fresh fruit. I mean, I always remember from, he loves gardening, was a great gardener, still is. And, every Sunday he'd ride his bike down to the farmer's market and, go and pick out whatever the, great seasonal produce was. And so it was a really big thing for him to, show us what a peach that literally has, been picked the day before by that farmer coming directly to you at ideal ripeness is versus, going to just the supermarket and getting it. So I was always very, very aware of that. My father also was the president and co-owner of a large landscape construction business. And I actually spent a couple of summers, just as a laborer for him. And so that's obviously planning, ornamental gardens and landscaping, but I did learn a lot about soil preparation and, sort of the culture of doing that. That was, mostly, Latinos that, were on that crew. I got to learn a lot. That's kind of where I started to learn a little bit about Spanish, was being able to work there in those summers. And so it's got a lot of those similarities, but yeah, I didn't really know anything about wine itself.
And that's always a good place to start, that beginner's mindset, a place of ignorance about something and then getting the chance to really dig in. Can you talk about the original idea for what this film was going to be and then when it made that transition to being a film about a family?
Yeah, for sure. So in 2015, I'd been doing these branded films, which, it's still kind of my day job, and I absolutely love what I do. I get to do, these short documentaries for corporate clients, nonprofits, and really dig in and find real stories within your organization to be able to connect your audience with your real overall mission. And so I got a grant with the Santa Cruz Mountain Wine Growers Association to do one of these pieces. Didn't know anything about wine. And, the grant allowed us to be able to film the vintage of 2015. So we got to go up multiple times throughout the year with four separate wineries. And one of those wineries was Mount Eden. And the second I went up there, I just fell in love with it because it's sort of trapped in time. It's kind of what a winery is going to look like back in the 70s and the 80s. It doesn't have a tasting room. It's, kind of dusty. And, you get up there and you are in a working winery as opposed to, sort of the more, tasting room style
Corporate kind of,
experience versus a marketing experience, right?
yeah, for sure.
And so I knew I was really interested in them then, but I kind of did that project for that whole year, and I started to learn about wine and got really into it, and kept working. And then in 2016, I was really looking for a personal passion project, something that I could do as an art project that I was interested in on my own. And so I approached Ellie Patterson, and she's the co-owner of Mount Eden. And I said, Ellie, I get this idea where I'd love to come up and film the vintage of 2017 and really focus on the labor, because a lot of people don't understand how labor intensive it is to actually be able to produce these wines. I mean, they're done in the mountains, so it's almost all done by hand. It's very labor intensive. It's a small winery, so they have a small crew, and it's absolutely beautiful up there. And so I wanted to document that. And she said, that sounds great. So I spent a whole year going up, a couple days a month, and basically filming whatever work was going on. Did a couple of interviews with Jeffrey and Ellie, but everything that we talked to them about was very much about their winemaking concept and sort of how they approached winemaking and a little bit about the history. But I, started editing that thing, and I came back and I realized I didn't have a story. I didn't really have a personal angle. It was beautiful, beautiful film, but it was not, there was no human connection to it. And ironically, just about that time, I got another call from Ellie, and she was like, "Well, our son Reed has decided to come back and start working here, and he's considering, potentially taking over the winery from us, as we get older." At the time, Reed was 23, I think, and Jeffrey and Ellie were in their, kind of mid-60s, so they were starting to really think about what the, next phase looks like as they consider retirement. So I said, "Sure, I'll come up and interview him." And, as I did that interview, the film pretty much instantly changed the second we sat down and started talking, because Reed absolutely loves, the family winery, loves Mount Eden. He grew up there, but he's very conflicted about it. He's not sure he wants to commit this much energy and that much of his time and passion to run a winery like this. He's literally seen his parents dedicate probably 75 to 80% of their energy and their lives to the production of this wine and the running of this estate. And he wasn't sure he, wanted to do that. He wasn't sure that that's what the life that he wanted to have. But at the same time, he also didn't want to let it go, and he knew it was really important to them and him. And so then the daughter came back, Sophie, and she had a lot of the same feelings. And it got really interesting because we started to see that at that point, this project that had been, maybe just, filming for a year, and then we're going to edit it and be done, within 2 years or something, it was going to take time because I really needed to allow that to naturally progress. Like, we needed to let Sophie and Reed be back at home and work with their parents and work with Mount Eden over multiple years, because they changed, the parents changed, Mount Eden changes a little bit, it changes the people. And so we ended up spending 7 years doing that, really be able to document this, really interesting transition that happened in everybody's lives.
Well, it's so cool. It's such a great lesson about, not over prescribing in your art and allowing things to happen organically, and to just listen to people, just listen to them and find the story that way, kind of in a almost a journalistic capacity. I want to talk a little bit about the history of Mount Edens, but before we go there, I want to talk about the environment, because that's part of the thing that makes Mount Eden unique is its environment. And then there's that fancy French word terroir, which is essentially just a fancy way of saying the environment. And can you describe what makes Mount Eden unique? I mean, we're talking about soil, we're talking about the climate, we're talking about the landscape. How is it different from a winery you would drive past, going into Calistoga or Napa Valley?
For sure. Yeah, I mean, one of the first things you'll instantly notice if you ever get to go up to Mount Eden, it literally is on its own mountaintop. It does not have any neighbors. When you say that this is a mountain winery, you mean it, man. I mean, it is like up at the top of the mountain is all the, the main vineyards that they have, and then they have a couple other plots, spread out. And so two of the things that I always point to about this place is, one, that it literally is only the estate grown fruit that is grown on this particular mountaintop. So that by nature is going to make it somewhat unique, because it doesn't really share the same exact soil structure as any of its neighbors, because just, from a geological standpoint, it kind of can't. It is its own mountain. You have to go a ridge over in order to be able to get to another winery that, has a different soil structure and series. Another one of the things that's really cool about that place is that so much of it is surrounded by the natural habitat. You have, oaks and, madrone and all of this beautiful natural vegetation that, surrounds those vineyards. And that, there's something about, really good wine in very specific places where, when the vines get old enough, the root structure actually digs deep enough that somehow it communicates some elements of that natural vegetation and those natural surroundings into the actual fruit that then becomes part of the wine. And that is such an amazing thing. It's very much a cool vineyard. You know, that's how they're able to have, you know, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay there. But then about, you know, on the same mountain, about 1,000 feet lower, they also grow Cabernet Sauvignon, which is really, really unique, man. I mean, you get a lot of wineries that will have Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. Those are traditionally the Burgundian grapes. And so, you know, in Burgundy, obviously the winemakers would say that those two could be grown together. And then Cabernet Sauvignon is a Bordeaux varietal. So that's a region that's, I mean, I don't know, it's got to be 400 miles from Burgundy. Totally different soil structure, different climate, different everything. And, you know, if you're in France, they are literally never going to be able to plant those three all together because there are regulations that have been built upon hundreds and hundreds of years of, you know, sort of culture and legacy that are like, nope, those grapes don't grow together. Here in California, anything goes, man. It's the Wild West. You do whatever you want. And so Mount Eden has shown that somehow you can actually grow all three of those varietals together and make really, really interesting, unique expressions of each one that all still have an element of Mount Edenness. I mean, there's always a really nice high acidity in all of their wines because it's cooler climate. So they're not like the big, you know, sort of, you know, meaty, heavy fruit focused wines. They go really well with food, which I absolutely love because they're lower alcohol and they are a little bit earthier, which is really, really cool. You can taste sort of the, you know, that mountain soil and that sort of wild feral character that you get from mountain fruit. So those are all the kind of things I tend to point to people.
Yeah. Well, and I got the chance to live in the Lodi area for a year,
Sure.
and I would drink a lot of those jammy Zinfandels, and then when I would get a nice soft Pinot Noir, it was like my palate got a refresh. I mean, I
Wow.
love a jammy Zin, but just a nice soft Pinot or a subtle Chardonnay is always a kind of a nice contrast. Now, I think a lot of people in California have this sense that it's Napa Valley and then everybody else. But you have all these pockets of wine growing, even near where I am, near Fresno, we have a wine trail here. And so there's all these kind of unique places where wine is grown in California that people don't expect. I mean, I love Amador County, for example, near Sutter's Creek. There's just
Love
all
that
these
guy.
amazing pockets. So what's distinctive about the wine world in Santa Cruz that you learned through making this film?
So yeah, in Santa Cruz Mountains, one of the things that's really cool about it is that, like, geographically, it's three counties, parts of three counties anyway. It's enormous. And the thing is, they produce very, very little wine because it's all elevation based. In order to be able to be a winery that is considered a Santa Cruz Mountain, you know, Appalachian winery, I think you have to be able to be at, I think it's 400 feet elevation and above. Don't quote me on that, but I think that's what it is. And so you're literally building these things into the mountainside. It's a pretty young mountain, too. And so they're all very small plots. And a lot of people don't know about these wineries because their production is very, very low. You know, I mean, you're talking, you know, Mount Eden makes like 10,000 cases, which it's not that that's not a lot of wine, that, you know, that's not a lot of wine. That is a decent amount of wine, but it's nothing compared to a much larger winery that, you know, people are going to run across all the time. I mean, that you're looking at, you know, 100,000 to, you know, 500,000 cases and above. So they're all small production and they're very spread out. We're never going to be able to have, like, you know, up in Napa, of course, you have like the wine train, you know, which literally you get on that train and you can go and visit, you know, 10 wineries in the same day. They're all right next to each other. In the Santa Cruz Mountains, you got to drive up these, you know, dusty dirt roads that are steep and, you know, it takes you
It's a
45 minutes.
pilgrimage.
Yeah, it's a pilgrimage, man. You can maybe hit two, maybe three if you want. It is a pilgrimage. It is very much like that. It feels like you're in, you know, Italy trying to go from cathedral to cathedral and do the pilgrimage for sure.
Can you talk about the ownership of the property before the Pattersons? And I know that there was an important figure, Martin Ray, that was involved. Can you talk about the history of the land before they got there?
For sure. Planted in 1943 by this guy, Martin Ray, that, you know, is a well-known and well-respected figure, but he's also very controversial as well. He's a pretty wild guy. He had actually bought the winery next door that was called the Palmasan Winery. It's now known as the Mountain Winery, and it is mostly a music venue. It's a really, really cool music venue. But that was actually a very famous place that was planted around the turn of the century. The Palmasan one was, and he was making champagne wines, and he was kind of California's first, you know, wine celebrity. I mean, he literally had huge parties up there at his chateau in the hills above Saratoga and would get Hollywood stars. They got pretty wild, kind of Great Gatsby-esque. And Martin Ray was a kid that grew up in the area and decided that he wandered up there one day, you know, because he just wanted to know what this place was. And he kind of befriended Palmasan and, you know, helped him out and out in the vineyards and that kind of stuff, and left, went off, did his own thing, became a, I believe, a stockbroker. And then after, you know, the depression and, you know, the stock market crashed, he really realized he obviously had to rethink his career. And years later, came back, bought the Palmasan's winery from him, ran it for about, you know, 7 or 8 years, ended up selling it to Seagram's, the Canadian whiskey company, and took that money and went. And, you know, when Palmasan had first been approached by Martin Ray, Paul was like, you know, if I were you, I would actually, instead of buying my winery, I would plant on the next ridge over if I had this to do again. And Martin Ray was like, nah, man, I can't handle, you know, starting from scratch here. But about 7 or 8 years later, after he'd sold to Seagram's, he decided he was ready to do that. And he went and planted Mount Eden, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Cabernet, a little bit of Riesling, actually, as well, which is kind of a really, you know, much lesser known thing. And, you know, did that, made really, really interesting wines that some years were absolutely amazing, some of the best wines anybody ever had. Some years they were not very good. He was always experimenting, always trying different things. Like, supposedly one year he tried cooking his wine, like all different kinds of wild things. And he also was, he wasn't probably the best businessman. And so he had cash flow problems out the, you know, up the wazoo, as they would say. And so he kept bringing on different investors, and he wanted to have total control. And so he'd bring on all these small investors, like 6% of the time. And he got to the point where, before he knew it, over a couple of years, he'd given up the majority of his business to all of these separate investors. All of them only had, you know, 5 to 6%, small amount, and they were losing money hand over fist because he just couldn't figure out how to make ends meet. Still making good wine, but not any money. And so they eventually, in the 70s, got, you know, kicked him out. They got rid of him because they knew it wasn't working. And so multiple winemakers came on over the next about 7 years, all throughout the 70s. They made really good wine, but nobody could stay for more than about a year or two because just the corporate culture, I think, was really bad. I think you had all these frustrated investors that all wanted to get liquid, get their money back, and didn't know what to do. They were losing money. And so they'd get frustrated, and nobody really wanted to keep working there for very long. And in 1981, Jeffrey Patterson was hired as, you know, really essentially the cellar hand. He was kind of the assistant winemaker up there. And he hadn't really had much experience in the wine industry. It was his first job. And he was a really hard worker, spent that year. And lo and behold, you know, the shareholders came in and they fired literally everybody, as they, you know, had a tendency to do. And he and his wife, Ellie, who was living up there with him, Ellie was able to kind of convince the CEO to, you know, elevate Jeffrey up to the level of being the winemaker. and let her become the, you know, the CEO and the president to run the business side, run the sales side. And she had no experience in running a business of that size or any sales at all. But, you know, they trusted him. And they also sort of made a pact that they would sort of, you know, get out of the way. The investors would not be as heavily involved. And they would let the Patterson sort of run it the way that they were going to do it. And they spent 40 years, Jeffrey and Ellie, you know, making fantastic wine, slowly building the business. They built a new, you know, cellar. And over the course of that, they slowly started buying, you know, shares whenever they could get an opportunity. They got a little extra money. They kept buying shares and buying some of these investors out. And in 2009, they actually were able to become the majority shareholders of, you know, Mount Eden Vineyards, which is just a dream. I don't think that kind of thing's ever going to really happen again in, you know, Saratoga. It's these things are worth so much. It's pretty rare to think that you would start as just a, you know, sort of seller hand and work your way up to become the majority shareholder. So they've had a pretty amazing life.
Yeah. One of the kind of features of the conflict, if I can call it that, in the documentary is the decision of whether to pass it on or to sell. And the decision to sell is part of the economic question of, you know, work to profit ratios and, you know, the increasing corporatization of the wine industry. Can you talk about how the potential draw of that to want to sell and kind of some of the economics behind it?
Oh, for sure. Obviously, there's a lot in there. And what you're really seeing is so many of these small boutique wineries selling to much larger corporate interests. And, you know, so you're really starting to get, and you get this in obviously a lot of industries, much larger companies that are getting bigger and bigger portfolios, and it's becoming harder and harder to be able to have small independent wineries. And, you know, in this particular case, because it's on a mountaintop, because it's so exclusive, the value of this property, what they would actually be able to sell it to, probably if they even literally sold it to a private individual, like a, you know, tech billionaire, let's imagine, they would be able to get a really, you know, favorable price, because not only would it be based on the actual valuation of the product that they are producing, this wonderful wine, but the exclusivity of it, that this isn't, you can't replicate a winery like this. And, you know, you really can't have another winery that would be even really all that similar. And
It's a
so
one of one.
it's a one of one, man. That price tag just jumps way up there, you know, more than doubles what it would naturally be, because you, as the potential owner, would be the only person that has something like that. You know, it's kind of a, you know, a Hearst Castle, as it were, of
Yeah.
the industry.
Wow. And then let's talk kind of abstractly about this, and we can get to the specific situation, the Pattersons, in a second. So you've got this work that I don't want to speak for millennials or Gen Z, but this work that different generations took as a given, but perhaps I'm a millennial, but perhaps my generation and then the generation behind me maybe isn't part of their I'm trying to figure out the nice way to say this, isn't part
I
of
know
our
what you're getting at, man.
yeah lifestyle agenda. And then obviously that transition, that's the feature of this documentary, is transitioning it from a generation that just broke their backs to make this work to a younger generation. And so I guess my roundabout way of saying is, do you think in light of all of this that small boutique wineries that rely on this, you know, sweat and blood have a future in California, given changes in what we're seeing in that work-life balance, quote unquote?
That's a really interesting question, Jordan. Obviously, I've thought a lot about that, because that really did sort of become kind of the central theme over the years. And one of the fun things when you work on a project for 7 years, you get to think about it a lot.
Yeah, and I don't want to talk about Reed specifically yet because we'll get to him, but just kind of
Yeah,
in
sure.
general, what your
Yeah,
reflections
we
are.
can talk in general about it. I think, you know, it's an interesting thing. I think that, you know, transitioning to family business is, I think, a very, very challenging thing at this point in time. And in particular, you got to understand this is in Silicon Valley. So I grew up in Silicon Valley, and sort of the culture of, growing up there was that the kids, were largely encouraged to change the world. You're looking around, you're seeing a new, Apple and Google and Facebook popping up left and right. And so everybody is like, wow, you need to find some magical idea that's going to fundamentally change the way that humanity functions, that, your parents could never understand and your grandparents could fundamentally, definitely not ever be able to understand. And so, we're trained in this culture of thinking that we're unique and special snowflakes, or every single one of us is going to go and do something different. And, then you couple that with this idea of having a family-run business, which is, not about being necessarily an individual. It's about accepting that you're part of a link in the chain and, finding a way to, make it personal to you. You can make, certain impacts that are unique to you, that are different than what your parents did, or your grandparents did, or what your kids will do someday, all that. But it's not the same, groundbreaking that, you would traditionally get. And so that's a huge conflict. And I think that's going to be very challenging for, small boutique wineries to be able to continue that. And also, because it's such a passion-oriented business, it is, literally, it is a life choice to run a winery like this. I mean, you have to be all in. It's tremendously difficult to do it. And so it's, you have to really, really want it. And that's hard because if, you as the original founder, let's imagine, love this thing, how do you pass that passion on to your children and make sure that they love it the same way you did? And that becomes a really hard question. So I think that's going to be a really interesting and unique challenge that we're going to have with a lot of boutique wineries, and we're already having it.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and just jump into the family because it allows us to kind of talk through these themes in specificity. So in many ways, I viewed this story as about a family inheritance and then a conflict about what that means for each of the people. Can you discuss how you watched Reed and Sophie evolve over the course of the filming? And then what do you think caused the evolution? Was it family dynamics? Was it them growing up and figuring out what was right for them in adulthood? Was it them recognizing what they had and maybe hadn't been able to see it because they were so close to it? Like what caused the change in them?
I mean, those are great questions. And, like starting with Reed, I feel like when I first met him, he was still very much dealing with, sort of that Silicon Valley growing up sort of mythology, let's call it, that I was talking about, where he was raised to sort of believe that he was supposed to go off and, find his passion and do his thing that would, change the world. And he had literally gone off and, had a coffee company that he had started down in San Luis Obispo. And, I think he, was actually even doing pretty well with it, but it wasn't making him happy. And I think that was a very difficult conflict for him, because he didn't understand why it wasn't making him happy. He just knew that he didn't like the way that he was feeling about, where he was in his life. And so he decided to come home, largely because he didn't really necessarily know where else to go and what to do. And he had always, at the beginning, had this sort of mental blockage around manual labor in particular. His father, Jeffrey, is the kind of guy who, spent most of his life waking up at the crack of dawn and, really, is of that generation and that belief that a good, day's work is about the amount of, manual labor and physical labor that you can actually accomplish. He doesn't really put much stock in sitting at a computer and sending off, 100 to 1,000 emails in a day. That's not Jeffrey. Jeffrey's the kind of guy that's like, I got to go dig a trench. I got a tractor breaks down. I got to go fix it.
I
He's
have those relatives. I get it.
right. And I fell in love with that. It's like almost, it's such an iconic male figure that it's like, oh man, I'm a big fan of Westerns. And it's like, he has a lot of like John Wayne in there, right? My grandfather
Yeah.
a John Wayne kind of a dude. And so I could relate to that. And, you know, Reed was really, you know, really, really cautious about that. And then I think as he, you know, decided to, you know, commit to working the vineyard at first, you know, he spent the first 2 years while he was up there really just being a laborer. He would just go out there and work every day with the vineyard team and do all of that, you know, hard manual labor. And it was really hard for him. I mean, he is not that kind of a person that, you know, places all of his value in his physical production. It's not easy for him. And I think the interesting thing was that when he went through that, he did start to identify what some of his real values are and where he can add value. And to give, you know, both Jeffrey and Ellie, his parents, credit, they were open to listening to Reed and having him, you know, sort of find his personal space. And so he kind of came to them, you know, in that second year of doing all this labor and was like, well, you know, guys, I'm not, you know, the one that's going to be the, you know, the heavy lift. I'm not the horsepower side of this. I can be a little bit more of the brain power. And the piece that he really got interested in, where he really started to develop a lot, was in management. He's really good at understanding how to make sure that all that he listens to all of their employees, all the, you know, vineyard team, what they really need, what they're asking for, what the cellar team is asking for, and how to actually, you know, make sure that all that stuff runs a lot smoother. And so over the recent years now, after having been back there for, you know, 7 years, Reed is now a manager and it's running way smoother. The lines of communication, you know, with the, you know, vineyard teams are running way smoother. They're, you know, all feeling better and the vineyards are looking great. And you know, the cellar, you know, looks a lot better and everybody knows what's happening. And so he really was able to kind of figure out where his personality does fit with this. And so that was a really cool transition. And I feel like Sophie was a really interesting one, because when she, you know, she talks a lot about in, you know, high school, she couldn't wait to get off the mountain. She just wanted to get away from this thing as much as possible. And she, you know, decides to come back because she wanted to be a part of the family business. And she's really sort of found herself in the, you know, direct to consumer side of it, the event side of it, really helping Mount Eden sort of transition, be able to be seen by a new generation. I think a lot of it for her, she has a great part in the film where she talks about none of them like to be told what to do. None of those four.
Who doesn't? Right? Who does? I mean,
I don't know, but they really don't. They are all rugged individualists, which I think was one of the things I really responded to, because I am as well. I've always worked for myself, done things my own way. And so they all had to sort of figure out how to be able to let these four very unique individual people sort of bring what they bring to it. And it ain't easy. It's not clean. It can get messy. They definitely still have plenty of conflict. But ironically, another one of the things that sort of happened through the film, because my process is sort of, it's very much about trying to help any character that becomes a main character in one of my films go through their story and sort of identify what is your personal narrative? What is it that, you know, you're trying to do in the story that you're telling? And then how does that intersect with all of these other personal narratives that these people that you live very intimately with are telling? And I sort of feel like that, you know, helped them a little bit. It's interesting having them watch the film. They actually understand a little bit more about each other because they get to see the other person's perspective, you know, really, really telling their version of the story. And it's a little bit of an eye-opening experience. So that was an interesting thing that I didn't know was going to happen.
Yeah. And I want to spend a moment with Jeffrey and thinking about passing something on that you've created and fashioned in a certain way. and then allowing a child to take it their own way. What is his mindset around that transition? And you'll have someone that kind of drove the business, created its identity, and then oftentimes can have a difficult time of letting go and giving others the freedom to choose how to run it. And it sounds like that's been true in management, and that's been true in, you know, the customer relationship through the kids. But, you know, there may be other transitions that'll be difficult for him to process. So what's your perspective on how he is viewing this transition?
That was another one of the things that fundamentally got really fascinating for me, especially I feel like in this point in time in our country, we're really seeing this generational transition, you know, for this, you know, transition from the baby boomer to, you know, the millennial, the Gen X, Gen Z, whatever we want to, you know, call that one, but whatever that next generation is. And so that became really, really fascinating because, you know, Jeffrey is very much a hands-on kind of person. And a large part of his success was based on his ability to really do things the way he wanted to do it and, you know, have the runway to do it. And I think that a big part of Mount Eden's success was that he and Ellie were great partners in the sense that they each knew their lanes and stayed out of each other's business. She, you know, handled the, you know, sales and the marketing and, you know, the running of the business. Jeffrey makes the wine, and they were really good about knowing those two avenues. And so it has been a significant challenge for him to bring on, you know, obviously his kids and let them, you know, be heavily involved and have their personal passions sort of guide some of the decision making. And the interesting thing is that I thought it would be even maybe harder for Jeffrey than it was going to be. But I think one of the things that I learned about Jeffrey through this experience is of filming this and getting to know them pretty intimately. He has such a long view of things. And that's one of the things I absolutely love about him. He, you know, Jeffrey has this ritual, which features in, you know, quite a bit in the film, where every single night after dinner, he goes and he smokes a cigar on his porch. And sometimes he reads. And sometimes he literally just is out there smoking the cigar and looking out on his gorgeous view and thinking and processing about life. And I think he sort of likes to meditate and he likes to think about things in the long term. And one of the things we talk obviously a lot about is that, you know, both his wine, which is made to, you know, age, the newer vintages are going to outlive him. They are going to be around longer than he is and, you know, still beautiful and still evolving, and people will open those. And same thing with planting a vineyard. That's a big part of the film as well. We tracked the actual process of them planting a vineyard. And when you do that, that vineyard will last a lifetime. And so that's not him planting that vineyard so that he's going to be able to bear that fruit and have that experience. That's so that, you know, Reed and Sophie and, you know, Sophie's daughter, Eden, you know, can potentially have that. And there was some sense of solace for him in that, being able to know that, you know, this vineyard existed before he was ever there. It was planted by Martin Ray and, you know, has a legacy that goes well back before then. And it will continue on beyond him. And
he can see his role kind of in the history of wine in that particular place and connect himself to the past and the future.
For sure, man. And it's so cool getting to see that. It is still really hard for him. It's not like it's easy for him to not be the decision maker on a lot of things, but he has a little bit of a sense of scope and scale that I think has largely been informed by the craft that he has committed his life to. Because that's the other part about this thing. When you're making wine the way that they make it, he's not really in control, man. The weather does what the weather does. If it's going to be a wet year, it's a wet year, and you are reacting to that. You do your best, but you don't have control over when it's going to rain. And that's sort of, I think, you know, has infiltrated every aspect of his personality, where he's able to understand that whether he likes it or not, man, he's reaching an age where he no longer gets to do this work on a daily basis. And so somebody else is going to have to do it again, whether he likes that or not. And it's kind of a beautiful, profound thing watching him go through that experience.
The last narrative layer that I want to talk about is obviously the divorce that features in the documentary. I think there's a lot of different ways you could frame it. You know, you could use the kind of that almost tired narrative that we have at this point of someone, you know, get digging in so deeply into their work that they become blinded to the things around them. But then there's also just a more, I don't know, realistic narrative that people change and that over time people move apart. How did you think about framing what happened with Jeffrey and Ellie?
That was definitely the hardest part of the film, the most complicated part, because I mean, I'll, fully tell you, I was kind of blindsided. I didn't see it coming. And, I will never forget, I got the call from Ellie at the end of 2020 that she and Jeffrey had gotten divorced and she had, left, living up in Mount Eden, still working there. She still is, but she was living separately. And it was a shock because I was like, oh my God, like I have been always thinking about this as this, perfect family and this perfect family unit. And yeah, okay, they totally have challenges. Every family does, but they are sort of living that idyllic dream. And, all of a sudden that, became apparent that that isn't necessarily the story. And then I had to go through this experience of realizing that so much of life, and in particular as a filmmaker, is about perspective. It's not about what you're looking at, it's about the angle that you're taking and what you're looking at. And we all have selective view. We see what we want to see. It's actually really a fascinating thing. When Jeffrey watches this movie, he sees exactly what he wants to see and chooses not to see the things that he doesn't want to see. He just happens to be one of those kind of people. And I think to a certain extent, we're all like that, Jordan. And so this was such an interesting personal experience for me, realizing that I had been seeing this story in a very particular way. And I needed to take a step back and sort of consider other angles to be able to cover it from. And so I started to go back through all of the different footage that I'd filmed over all of these years. And you start looking at it again with these new eyes. And all of a sudden, you start to see what was always there, which you can see, it's not necessarily that Jeffrey and Ellie were fighting. They weren't yelling at each other. They were never that kind of a couple that, had big blowups, They're not the, Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor, Instead, you could just see sort of these moments of discomfort for Ellie, and these moments of, sort of these sort of sideways glances occasionally where, you can see that sort of frustration. And that was so fascinating going through that experience of looking back through to find that footage to be able to support that narrative. And I did a lot of looking and watched a lot of different films that deal with divorce and read a lot of narratives that deal with divorce. And what I found is that there's this tendency in art to want to come conceptualize it and dramatize it, make a reason. There's, we want to define why a divorce happened. And to the point where it's probably because, those of us that are married watch that kind of thing and find out that somebody got divorced. And we answer them about, oh man, where did it go wrong? So that I can make sure I don't make the same mistake, right? And I personally, in a lot of cases, think that that's not really what happened. I think that what happened in this case is that, Ellie and Jeffrey were together for 40 years. And so much of their, relationship had really grown to be this professional relationship built around building Mount Eden, the winery and the brand. And, the personal relationship that had taken a back seat because they could always talk about what the business needed and what the wine needed. And then they also had the kids. And so they could always talk about what the, what's going on with the kids and what they're concerned about and be, parents together. And as they, got older, and particularly for Ellie, as she, starts to feel a little bit of comfort about, hey, we got a succession plan here. I don't need to worry so much about the kids. I don't need to worry so much about the business. So Ellie started asking all these really interesting questions. But what kind of comes next? What's the next stage beyond Mount Eden? And then I guess that got to be this really interesting thing, because all of a sudden a big part of her personal identity that really has been, sort of sitting in the back seat for a really, really long time starts to pop into the foreground. And it's kind of that one of those unique sort of inflection points in your life where, when you're really considering retirement, and especially in a job like this where it's been such a large part of your life, it really is a huge transition in a completely different world. And so I guess I start watching all these. I think, did you get the part where I, watched all the documentaries? And yeah, of course. So I think that it was really interesting basically seeing her start to ask questions about what she wanted out of life beyond having Mount Eden. And it becomes sort of this thing where people just evolve over time. And occasionally we just evolve in different ways. And, it's funny, it sort of became this fun parallel to wine, because with their wine, you sort of imagine what a vintage is going to be like when it ages. You have all these indicators and markers and all this stuff in there. The acidity is going to be like this, and then, alcohol levels sort of going to carry you somewhere. But it's always surprising when you actually open it, 20, 30 years down the line, it never evolves exactly the way that you would think it would. And that's one of the wonders and the beautiful things about wine. Sometimes it's so much better than you ever thought that wine would ever be 30 years down the line. And then sometimes it's totally disappointing. You thought this is going to be like, one of those wines that would last forever. And you open it and you're like, oh, it's kind of pasta. Like, it actually lost so much of its fruit that it's just not that great anymore. And it's out of balance. And I think that's to me is kind of, I think what happened with that divorce is that these two people just sort of evolved in different ways over time. And Ellie has the amazing courage to realize that she wanted something different than the life that she thought she was going to be able to have with Jeffrey would be able to supply her with. And she made this amazingly courageous decision, when she's got grandkids and, the kids have just come back and they all live at this winery and they're all built around it. She's like, no, this isn't necessarily what I want at this point, which is really, really interesting, man. Really courageous. She did that.
Yeah, it's a fascinating decision and a brave decision to do what you need to do for yourself in the midst of all of these constraints. I want to pull back now. This is a story about a family, but it's also a story about a place. And it's really a story about people in California. And I'm curious, through this process, what do you understand about California differently than when you started this process? What have you learned about wine's role and the history of the state and just people living here? And yeah, it's kind of a broad question, but I'm curious what it's taught you about California.
Oh man, that is a broad question, but it's, it's not something I haven't thought about a lot. I mean, I'm like fifth generation Californian. My great, 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 I believe, grandfather, I can never remember how many greats are in there, came over from Scotland in 1864. And my family has been in California ever since. So I have really deep roots here and I've thought a lot about California. And for me, one of the things that I get really interested in is the mythology, that's the Western frontier. And there's always, sort of been to me this feeling of this is the, the place of progress. We're on the cutting edge of progress. And we're always pushing as far as we possibly can to be able to do that. And I guess this film sort of taught me the importance of appreciating your roots and what's actually grounded. Something in the roots of Mount Eden is in those children, is in both Reed and Sophie. And even though they were attracted to sort of the California mythology of, pushing the boundaries to try and, build something new, do something that had never been done, do something that her parents had never done, sort of become sort of pioneers. They both listened to that root nature of their connection to Mount Eden, and it brought them back. And personally, I found that really settling because it's like I, live so close to Silicon Valley where everything is so immediate and shifts so much. It just constantly changing, and we're, constantly obsessed with, progress and change, that there's this, beautiful calming nature to realizing that, this lifestyle of, this sort of agrarian lifestyle of working this land and producing this fruit and caring about this craft is something that, is so deeply ingrained in the roots of our culture. We, we kind of can't get away from it, and nor should we. It was there in the very, very beginning. And I guess that was a really nice thing for me to feel, because I've always, as a lot of us have felt that pressure to try and do something new and different and boundary pushing. And I'm not that kind of a person. I'm actually a very foundational person. Obviously, 7 years to make this film. I move very slowly, but I move steady. And most of like my filmic references, most of my favorite films are from like, the 60s and the 70s and before. I'm not the kind of guy that's going to be pushing new techniques. There are a lot of filmmakers that do that, and I, really, admire them for that, but that's not me. I am much more rooted and grounded in something a lot older. And so it was nice for me to discover that connection to kind of an older, more foundational version of California that I hadn't really thought about.
We always close in the same place, which is books. What are a few book recommendations you'd have for listeners?
I do. I love to read. I got a couple of, I got kind of a really obvious one. I'm a huge John Steinbeck guy. East of Eden is one of my favorite books. And, you talked at the beginning of this thing about one of the things that's great in art, the really good art, is that it evolves with you. And, I read that book for the first time when I was probably 16 years old in high school, forced to read it. And I sort of liked it, but I was like, God, this thing is long and slow. And or, why is it necessary to go all the way into Adam Trask's father at the beginning? Like the opening, it seems so long at that point. And then I read it again, probably in my early 30s, and all of a sudden I could really, really connect to a lot of the, Christian mythology in there, and a lot of the love of the land. And then while I was making this film, I read it again, and now I'm a father. And so that really opened up and became this fascinating insight for me, being able to understand generational, transitions, and then also to, my parents are getting older. And so I really started thinking about legacy and what it's like to pass things on. So all of that stuff is embedded in there. And I love that book. I will always love East of Eden. Another good book I like to, tell people about is a book called Shuggie Bain, which is a Scottish book in Glasgow. And I'm trying to actually remember the author's name. He's a first-time writer, and I can't actually remember his name right now. But
Yeah.
the book is called Shuggie Bain, so Bain. And my wife is Glaswegian. She's Scottish, lived there until she was about 22. And she read this book first and, then passed it to me. And
Douglas Stewart, that's what it was.
Douglas Stewart, thank you. Douglas Stewart is his name. Thank you very much. It's a beautiful book that's a really interesting cultural insight into a very specific culture there. And she absolutely loved it because she grew up in a, pretty, traditional middle class family in Scotland, but they had all of these, working class, classmates in, in her village. And she never really understood their lives. They were always, you know, very separated. The class system is very, very strong still in all of the UK, but, you know, particularly in Scotland. And this book does such a great job of really showing, you know, the real existence of what it's like growing up in tenement houses outside of Glasgow, and that challenge when, you know, the manufacturing industry and the coal industry disappeared, you know, in the 70s and 80s, and all of these people all of a sudden, you know, found they didn't have jobs. And it's got a lot of parallels with what's going on in a lot of rural areas in the middle of our country and in the south, and really a lot more areas than that, but those are the ones you sort of, you know, pop up into your head. And he has a beautiful tone to it because there's sort of a lyrical quality to it. It deals with a lot of really, really hard subjects. I mean, his mother was an alcoholic who was, you know, became more and more abusive as times got harder and harder. And, you know, he was very much a neglected child, and it was really, really hard. And he grew up as a, you know, he grew up gay and knew he was gay very, very early on, and in a community where that was, you know, a not accepted, but not expected. And it's a really, you know, can be a hard book at times, but it always, he finds a beautiful way to be able to frame the humanity so that you never feel as dismal as it could have felt, you know, if it was just a more straightforward journalistic endeavor. So I love Shuggie Bain. Shuggie Bain is awesome.
Yeah. Well, that one's been on my list, so maybe you've reignited me to finally pick it up. I think it's sitting on a shelf somewhere in my house, and so maybe it's time to grab it. When is the film premiering? How can people watch it? What are the different places where it'll be screened? Can you give us some information about what's next?
Yeah, so we have our world premiere at the Cinequest Film Festival. And so that will be in San Jose on March 9th at 4:30. And I'm really excited about that. It's actually in one of the most beautiful historic theaters in the state. They just redid it in about 2007. It's a 1,000-seat theater called the California Theater. And so you can, you know, come out and see it March 9th, you know, 4:30 in downtown San Jose. We have a website called Eden Film, and that's really the best way to be able to track exactly where you're going to be able to see this. We're going to have screenings that are going to start popping up all throughout the state, really the country, and, you know, potentially even the world. And we are also actively starting to seek distribution. You know, I think we're going to find a really nice home for this film on a streaming service. That can take a while, as I'm sure you can imagine. But really, following us at edenfilm.info, there's a nice, easy opportunity to be able to get on our mailing list right there. There's a link that tells you all the screenings. So that'll be really the best place to be able to see exactly what's going on, how you can see the film.
Well, it's a good metaphor for wine. You know, good things come when you wait, right? And so if you can't make it March 9th, you know, it will continue to grow. And I really encourage people to seek this film out. It's so beautifully shot, has such a complex story that you can resonate with from different perspectives. And yeah, I'm excited for people to watch it so they can get their own experience. Thanks again, Chris, for talking with me. I really enjoyed the film and really connected with a lot of the pieces of it. So appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks so much, Jordan. It's been a real pleasure. And yeah, I mean, like you were saying, one of my favorite things about the film is that everybody finds sort of an entry point because, you know, we really, really focused on trying to tell the real stories of all four of these main characters in the Pattersons. And so everybody has a different take on it because, you know, you really get to sort of bring your personal history to it and then have your different interpretation. I love hearing all the different ways that people read all that stuff. So I'm really looking forward for people to see it and, you know, communicate to with us. So thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.